Good morning. On today's programme, how a children's story hour in a liberal US neighbourhood became a flashpoint for far-right protesters, and the removal of a pig farm in the Czech Republic to make way for a museum to commemorate Romani people living under Nazi rule. But first we go to Canada, where Pope Francis has concluded his six-day visit, the first papal visit there in 20 years. His main reason for the trip was to formally apologise for the wrongs done by church-run schools to Indigenous children for more than a century. He had apologised in March in Rome to an Indigenous delegation from Canada, but political and native leaders wanted that apology to take place on Canadian soil, and that was done twice, once in Edmonton and again in Quebec City. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, there was a mixed reaction to the Pope's words of apology.
The pressure on the Pope to come to Canada heightened after the discovery of hundreds of unmarked graves at the sites of some former residential schools across the country. The schools have been described as a black stain on Canada's history. They were funded by the government and run by churches. The Catholic Church operated about 60% of the 139 schools. The aim was to help assimilate native children into white culture. From the late 1880s to 1996, about 150,000 Indigenous children were taken from their families and forced to attend the schools. Thousands were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. It's estimated by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that between 4,000 and 6,000 children died from abuse or neglect while in the residential school system. They were also stripped of their languages and cultures. Among the recommendations by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a call for the Pope to issue an apology on Canadian soil for the Catholic Church's role in the schools. The 85-year-old pontiff arrived in Edmonton last Sunday to a welcome ceremony that included Canadian political and native dignitaries. On Monday, the Pope traveled to the home of the former Ermineskin Residential School at Maskawashese, south of Edmonton, to meet with survivors of residential schools. It was the only visit the Pope made in Canada to a former school. While there, he issued the long-awaited apology on Canadian soil. It was an emotional moment. The crowd cheered as he was presented with a gift of a traditional native headdress, which he then wore on stage. An Indigenous woman also stood before the Pope and sang, "O Canada," in her native Cree language. The Pope asked for forgiveness and said he was on a penitential pilgrimage coming to their native lands to tell Indigenous people in person of his sorrow and to pray with them and for them. He said the memory of the suffering endured by native children is painful. He added that it is necessary to remember how the policies of assimilation and enfranchisement, including the residential schools, were devastating. And he said he was deeply sorry for the ways that many Christians supported the oppression of Indigenous peoples, and he asked for forgiveness, in particular, for the ways in which many members of the church and of religious communities cooperated in projects of cultural destruction and forced assimilation, which culminated in the residential school system. He also said the apology is only a first step, and looking ahead, no effort must be spared to prevent such situations from happening. And an important part of the process will be to take a serious look at the past and to assist the survivors of the schools. The Pope also met with parishioners at the Sacred Heart Church of the First Peoples, the only Indigenous church in Canada. On Tuesday, he held an open-air mass at Edmonton's Commonwealth Stadium. As many as 70,000 people attended to listen to him and to mark the Feast of St. Anne. But some, including an Indigenous Catholic priest from Ottawa, said the Edmonton service was a missed opportunity for the Mass to celebrate Indigenous traditions and cultural practices. Instead, it was delivered in Latin, the same language the Indigenous children at the schools heard on a daily basis and that many associated with suffering. Some who listened to the apology said they could not sleep because it brought back painful memories. Many native leaders also took note that the Pope did not apologize for the actions of the Catholic Church, but only for the role of certain members of the Church. Marie Sinclair, who chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, said there was a deep hole in the apology by not acknowledging the full role of the Church in the residential school system. On Wednesday, the Pope traveled to Quebec City, where he met privately with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Mary Simon, Canada's first Indigenous Governor General. Speaking in Quebec City's historic citadel, he again expressed shame and sorrow for the actions that took place by Christians at the schools. Prime Minister Trudeau said the Pope's visit had an enormous impact on school survivors and added that the apology was only a first step, suggesting the Church needs to do more. Some Indigenous leaders have said the Pope's apologies have fallen short. And earlier, Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Mark Miller said there were gaps in the apology that could not be ignored, such as the omission of sexual abuses against Indigenous children at the schools, and that the Pope had referred earlier this week to the evil committed by individual Christians, but not the Catholic Church as an institution. After the Quebec ceremony, many Native leaders called on him to renounce the doctrine of discovery. They say the papal bulls that make up the doctrine are still being used today by states to dispossess and to disempower Indigenous people. The 15th century papal bulls were used by monarchs to claim Indigenous lands, saying they were uninhabited. It was how Europeans were able to justify their ability to take ownership and control over North American land. And Indigenous people see the doctrine as being at the root of so many issues they face today. On Friday, the Pope traveled to Canada's northernmost city, Iqaluit, and another private meeting with residential school survivors before flying back to Rome. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next, a story from Boston, where far-right groups targeted a children's story reading event. Drag Queen Story Hour was organized to entertain children and their parents, promote literacy, and spark a discussion about identity. But the event became a flashpoint when neo-Nazi protesters descended on a liberal neighborhood, and the residents there quickly mounted a counter-protest, as Alice Hutton reports.
The leafy neighborhood of Jamaica Plain in the east coast city of Boston is a liberal enclave filled with rainbow-colored wooden houses, breweries, and an unusually large number of LGBT families. At its heart sits the Loring Greenough House, one of the area's oldest surviving 18th century homes, a white Georgian mansion with dark green shutters that has been fought over for centuries. Built in 1760 by a British loyalist, the once 80-acre country estate was requisitioned by colonial forces during the Revolutionary War and turned into a military hospital. In the Civil War, it became the site of a memorial to fallen soldiers. And in the 1920s, it was saved from demolition by a group of women known as the Tuesday Club, who turned the home and lush gardens into a museum, community centre, where families sit under the apple trees, attend concerts, yoga classes and historical talks. Last week, however, the house came under fire again, from neo-Nazis. "Pedo scum of our streets!" bellowed 20 men wearing black face masks, standing on the pavement outside the house on a busy Saturday, in the middle of a city-wide heat emergency. Several of them unfurled a wide banner with the same slogan and hung it on the property's cast-iron fence. Suddenly, out rushed two grey-haired women in their 70s in wide sun hats. "No!" they yelled back at the intimidating group, ripping the banner down. "This is private property," one of them declared. Within 30 minutes of the group's arrival, word spread on social networks that Nazis were in JP. Residents jumped on their bicycles, fashioned makeshift signs, and set up a counter-protest on the opposite side of the road, screaming back just as loudly, if not louder. After a shoving match, the police made arrests on both sides for breach of the peace. What caused all this anger? Inside the Loring Greenough's cool floral-patterned drawing room, the drag queen, Patty Beret, flipped back her blonde wig, twirled her moustache, got out her ukulele and sang a song wishing the captivated dozen children and their parents a good morning, before opening page one of the spectacular suit, about one child's search for the perfect birthday outfit. Drag Queen Story Hour events are designed to promote literacy and spark discussions about identity and self-love through the use of books and colourful characters and costume, and are a frequent feature at libraries and schools across the US. They come from a strong cultural tradition in Europe as well, where pantomime dames, men in elaborate costumes and wigs, are a staple on the Christmas theatre scene. But whereas far-right groups in the US have long targeted abortion clinics like Planned Parenthood, especially in the wake of the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court, drag events are increasingly becoming a new flashpoint location for those looking to promote an anti-LGBT agenda. They use it to accuse LGBT communities of sexually abusing children, a common but baseless accusation. And despite the fact that one of the members of this group was recently arrested on alleged child pornography charges. The white supremacist organization which protested the law in Greenough is called NSC131. And in recent months, they have repeatedly attended drag events up and down the northeast coast. They ship in protesters to shout "off our streets" at children in cities and towns they themselves frequently don't live in. They are part of increasing attempts to turn anti-liberal protests into an industry rather than a grassroots movement, leaving local communities to decide on their own how to respond. After Saturday's raucous turn of events, the police dropped the charges against the counter-protesters, and 131's leader appeared in court facing a fine, with the district attorney calling him a disgrace and a warning. The parents who braved the event with their kids praised it as a blast that sparked their children's imagination and vowed to keep attending. The law in Greenough issued a statement standing with the LGBT community, saying, "We will not be bystanders in the face of bigotry." And what about Patty, the centre of all the fuss? Also known as Patrick Burr, the head of the Boston chapter of the National Drag Queen Storytime Organisation. He bills his stage persona on Twitter as a Lady Gaga tribute band under the tongue-in-cheek headline, "Not Capable of Murder." Well, he remains undaunted and resolved to do more events than ever. "Nazis, I guess, don't realise how much drag queens like attention," he said. This is Alice Hutton for World Report.
Finally, we go to the Czech Republic, where demolition work has begun on a pig farm built on the site of what was once a concentration camp for Romani people in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. The pig farm was built in the 1970s, but Roma groups have campaigned for decades to have it removed and a proper museum built in its place. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
I can still remember the smell. The stench, more like. I'd come to the small clearing at Leti Upisku, a village about halfway between Prague and the southern city of České Budějovice. I was attending a commemoration of the victims of the concentration camp that once stood there. Around me was a gathering of Roma activists and politicians, and a small crowd of mostly Romani onlookers. There were speeches and flowers were laid at the little stone memorial to the 1,300 people interned there during the war and the 326 who died of malnutrition, mistreatment and disease. But every few minutes, as we stood in sombre reflection, a terrible stench would sweep over the crowd, the acrid stench of pig manure that seeped far into the nostrils. People furrowed their brows, some covered their noses. It was a powerful symbol of the lack of dignity and respect shown to the Roma community by the modern-day Czech state, a pig farm built on the site of their greatest suffering. It's taken some 3 decades of complaints, pleas and urging to get it removed. The history of Leti is complex. Racists and far-right politicians have found it expedient to abuse that history, and even mainstream politicians, prime ministers and presidents, have casually dismissed and misinterpreted it. But there are many uncomfortable truths about Leti that historians say can no longer be overlooked. Leti did indeed begin life as a work camp, but the decree establishing such camps was actually passed by the Czechoslovak government, not the Nazi occupiers, on March 2, 1939, 2 weeks before the German invasion. Such camps were intended for those deliberately shunning work, the work-shy, drifters, vagabonds, to use the jargon of the time, as well as those who were deemed to be lazy or lacking in discipline. There were actually more than 2,000 such camps during the war. The construction of the camp at Leti started in July 1939, by which time Bohemia and Moravia had been made a protectorate of Nazi Germany. Leti didn't become an explicitly ethnic camp until 3 years later, in July 1942, when the SS ordered Bohemian Roma to be sent to Leti and Moravian Roma to be sent to a second camp in Moravia. But while that order came from the Nazi occupiers, the camp itself was staffed and run by Czech guards. Inmates were forced to log trees and build roads. The camp commandant, Josef Janowski, apparently ran it with great cruelty, but also great venality and incompetence. By Christmas 1942, a typhoid epidemic was raging out of control, and the camp was closed the following year. Those who'd survived the epidemic were sent to the Moravian camp, or directly to Auschwitz. There were attempts by the post-war Czech authorities to bring the guards to justice. Several, including Janowski, were arrested and charged with crimes including torture and theft. But none were convicted, and Leti was soon forgotten. Not, obviously, by the Roma of Bohemia and Moravia, more than half of whom were murdered in the Holocaust. Now, at least, there will be some closure. A proper museum will explain the convoluted history, not just of Leti, but of what the Roma call the Poremos. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week, but until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.